Thanks for listening to Exploring the Wine Glass podcast, the podcast for people who love wine. I'm Lori Budd, a UC Davis winemaking program and WSET Level 2 graduate. You can find Exploring the Wine Glass on all the socials, as well as your favorite podcast catchers. If you haven't subscribed yet, now's the perfect time. I promise I'll never tell you what to drink, but I'll always share what's in my glass. A few months ago, my friends over at Wine Pairing Weekend were discussing wines of South Africa. When the topic was announced, I immediately knew where to go to get the best South African wine. Alyssa and Ian Wolf of Red Wolf Imports. I met them online, of course, and was lucky enough to meet Liz in real life. It was interesting to me to learn about another side of the wine industry. Wine importing is intriguing, and how they got into it captivated me. If you would like to read my post about South African wine, it can be found at bit.ly/WPWSF. I felt that I couldn't do enough justice to Alyssa and Red Wolf Imports in the post, so I wanted her to come onto the podcast and tell us her story and to share what it is like to be a wine importer. While you're listening, please swipe or scroll and subscribe, rate, and review to Exploring the Wine Glass. It's a great way to show your support, let me know who is listening, and to help others find us. Sláinte! Hey, Alyssa, how are you doing?
I'm good, Lori. How are you?
I am good. I'm very happy because I'm actually on the right coast now. So, I get my 2 months of being in California, so I'm pretty darn happy.
Nice.
But thank you very much for joining me today on a Friday afternoon. Is it still raining there?
No, it is sunny, and I spent a few hours this morning weeding. It is very hot and very humid.
Oh, yuck. Yeah, that's something I definitely don't miss while I'm on this coast. I mean, we might get to 105 here in Fresno, or 110 in Paso, but it's dry. Yeah, so, and they always say, well, at least it's a dry heat. I'd rather have heat than humidity, because at least in Jersey, so I'm sure it's the same in DC. It can be 90 degrees, but 90% humidity, right? You feel like you've got a sweater on of sweat. It's disgusting. But we are here to talk about better things than humidity. So we are here to introduce people, or not introduce, because I think you are pretty well known in the social media channels. But I wanted to get a different view from the wine industry. Mm-hmm. So, I talk to a lot of winemakers and wineries and things like that. But in all honesty, you do something I don't even understand how that works. So I'm excited to learn more about importing and all that goes into that, because I'm sure just knowing what I have to do to be a winery, I'm sure there's loads of paperwork and loads of documentation and everything to bring wine in. But before we get into that, let's tell us a little bit about yourself. So, where did you grow up? What were your interests?
I grew up in New York. I grew up on Long Island, and the accent will come out intermittently. I've been living in the D.C. area for about 10 years. I went to college for physical therapy. I was a full-time physical therapist for about 10 years. Ran a clinic for 2 years, completely burnt out, and realized that I couldn't keep doing this. But I also couldn't retire because I was like 30. That wasn't an option. And we just were kind of keeping our eyes out for other careers, businesses we could run. We didn't really have any ideas. In 2014, my mother took us to South Africa. She had a big birthday, and we did a trip together and just went as tourists, visited Cape Town, did a safari, did the whole thing, went to wine country, had a blast, really impressed with the quality of the wines and the price points, and kind of had like you know, a list of producers or regions that we were interested in and wanted to try to find when we got back. We were living in D.C. at the time, which has a lot of fantastic wine shops, and we just kept being disappointed with what was on the shelves. Lots of value options, like under $10 wines, and lots of very high-end wines. You could see, like, Ken Forster's FMC, which is a beautiful wine. De Torrens line is all over the place. Some of the Hamilton Russells, but those are $50, $60 bottles. And, like, that's not the kind of wines that we drink, you know, maybe we drink something like that once or twice a year. So we saw a gap in the market. And my husband, Ian, who's also my business partner, he's an attorney. His father's an import-export attorney. Actually, he just retired. So he had a connection to ask, like, a lot of the logistical questions, legal questions, customs and freight forwarding questions. So he kind of started looking into that and then explained that to me. We actually read a book. Deborah Gray is an importer out of, she's Australian. She lives, I think, in Florida or Georgia. She wrote a book on how to import wines, and she actually did a really good job, at least of, like, giving you an outline. So we kind of were like, oh, maybe we can do this. Started very slowly, started with about, there was no way we were going to be profitable. We started with about 8 cases of wine on a container ship that you pay, I almost don't even want to say it. You pay a lot of money for, like, if you, with a container, whether you have 1 case or 800 cases, you pay the same. Right. So, while you're not buying that much wine, it's still very expensive to bring it over. But we just did a test run, and that was in spring of 2017. And then we're able to start selling some wine, having some customers. We found distributors to work with and kind of said, well, we've already got these shops. They're already carrying the product. Will you work with us? And it took a while, but somebody did eventually. Global Wines Maryland took a meeting with us. They're a small local company. Tasted through the wines, and you could tell they weren't really in a place that they were looking to expand their portfolio, but they tasted the wines and literally were kind of like, ah, crap, we're gonna bring these on. So that's kind of how we started.
So yeah. I understand the whole thing, because, like, the same thing applies for the wine industry in terms of, you know, we have a California license. That California license is X amount of dollars. And if we have 100 cases, 1,000 cases, you know, it's the same amount. So if you have 100 cases, that dollar amount is divided among 100 cases. So each bottle price or each case price is so high, you know, but as you get into that sweet spot, you know, as you produce more and more wines, that same dollar amount just gets divided over more bottles. So it actually brings the bottle price per bottle price down. But unfortunately, there's a lot of overhead, which I'm sure there is also, you know, there's a license for everything. So you have to start bringing in more or making more wine to make it just even somewhat cost effective. And I laugh. You're like, oh, you knew it wasn't going to be, you know, you knew it wasn't going to be a profit. You know, I guess the importing business is kind of the same as the wine industry joke, right? Yeah. How to make a million.
Don't get into it to make money. Well, yeah, it's not. It's close.
Yeah. You know, how to make a million in the wine industry. Start with 5 million, you know.
You don't get into it to make money. I don't know. I didn't. I guess if you come into it with a lot of money, maybe that's different. But those initial investments are definitely challenging unless you're already well-funded, and we were not. I'm a physical therapist. My husband went to law school, but he's been paying a law loan for forever. And he is not a lawyer now. He works for the government, so he doesn't. It's not like he's, you know, raking in crazy money. But so far, we've been able to make it work, I think, by being very patient, starting slowly, and just willing, I mean, kind of like you are, working multiple jobs, having day jobs because you have to still pay your mortgage, you have to still do all of those things, but just kind of slowly building so that you're not suddenly purchasing a tremendous amount of wine that you can't pay for.
Right.
Unfortunately, what some importers will do and then go out of business, And one of the reasons that we have been able to work with the wonderful producers we work with is an American importer, who I won't name, was working with a few South African brands, ordered basically like 6 containers over the course of, I forget what they said now, it was like 3 weeks or something, like very high volume. So that's, I mean, that's at least, so yeah, in a container you have between, like around 500 cases of wine. So 6 containers in 2 weeks, that's got to be somebody who's huge.
Right.
And they weren't. They were a husband-wife team who literally offloaded the containers themselves. So I don't know how they thought they were going to sell that much wine that quickly. The short story is they went bankrupt, sold their house, bought a boat, and like kind of just disappeared.
Oh, my God. And, of course, left all of the wineries hanging, right?
And they did not get paid. So, you know, they were a little wary of working with U.S. importers because of that experience.
Right. I get that. Yeah. My goodness. That's funny. Not that that's funny, but, I was reading somewhere that the same thing happened. I can't remember what I was reading because it wasn't South Africa, but it was another country. And, the same thing had happened to them where somebody came in and purchased all of these wines, you know, and they were left hanging. The wineries there were left hanging. You know, and how sad this is. Somewhere in the back of my brain, I'm thinking it's that book, Corked or something. Yeah. I forget what his name is, but somewhere in the story, I think when he's doing that, but it's kind of based on his real life. That's horrible. I'm blanking on his name and he's on social media, but whatever. It might be fiction. It might be truth. Who knows? But I've heard that happen in the past.
Yeah.
All right. So I'm going to backtrack a bit because, when I was looking, you know, I have to, you know, kind of look through the internet to find things about people that I'm talking to. You had gone to Ithaca.
Mm-hmm.
So, that Ithaca, I think, is beautiful. I think it's a beautiful area.
It's gorgeous. Yeah.
And there's like, I don't know, like 500 waterfalls in the area or something like that.
Yeah.
Mike and I used to hike and do things like that over there. But you weren't, I guess you were underage at that point, but no wine interest at all. I mean, you were kind of in the heart of the Finger Lakes.
I was not, when it was college, it was kind of bang for your buck as far as alcohol went, unfortunately. But I was in college from 2001 to 2005, which the Finger Lakes hadn't, I'm sure there were producers doing really good things then, but it hadn't, you could get a lot of really bad wine in the Finger Lakes at that time. So we would, when we were of age, we would sometimes like have somebody DD and do a wine tour and go around. We did not spit out any wine. I didn't know that was a thing. But the, like, even then I was like, okay, this is sweet. This is fruity. This is very juicy. But they were trying to grow like Cabernet Sauvignon in Ithaca. So it didn't really work. But it was beautiful. It was still fun to do. But I'd like to get back up there now. And there's a few folks on social media who are very active in the Finger Lakes. And I would love to, you know, learn a lot more about that.
Yeah. There's, Levi Dalton is representing them, and they're looking for summer harvest teams, and it's free. So like you apply, and if they accept you, they bring you there, all expense paid, to spend I think like 5 days or something there, being right in the heart of the Finger Lakes and learning how, you know, what a harvest is like and all of that stuff. So I thought that was cool. And I'm like, well, I could apply in California and they can fly me back to New York, but I kind of need to worry about my own grapes when they're worrying about their grapes. So.
I think I have so many tastings booked in August. I'm like, I don't have 5 free days.
Yeah. Right. Right. All right, so I was going to ask about physical therapy, but you have already said that you were burned out, and I get that. That's kind of, you know, you just, I think from the times that we've talked, I think we're kind of similar in the fact that we're always looking to do something. And I think that, you know, our personalities have the burnout factor ingrained in us. It's we're always looking to do something different and find the next true passion and do that. Okay, so I talked about it a bit in the blog post that I wrote, Unlocking the Marvels of Nature with South African Wine. But how you explained a little bit at the beginning about how your mother-in-law took you to South Africa, your mother, right?
Took
you to South Africa and you fell in love with that. But how did I've got to bring up the story of the Miami Dolphins, I have to. So share with us how that plays into the role there.
Okay. So I moved to Miami right after college, right after grad school. So I was around 23. It must have been my 24th birthday. Ian got me wine classes. Jimmy Cephalo, who's on the 72 Dolphins, opened a restaurant and wine bar. It was one of these restaurants where where the bottles are in the machine, it does an automatic 2 ounce pour. Do a tasting, or you could sit down and just have a dinner. It was an Italian place. But there was this gentleman, Henry, who was their wine director, and that you could pay for wine classes. Henry used to be one of the radio announcers for the Dolphins. That's how he knew Cephalo. Had a career changed. I think he actually worked for Franzia for a while and then kind of gradually got into fine wine. So I always called him Henry the wine guy. And I just remember I knew nothing about wine. I had had it at weddings. Occasionally we would buy it. I was maybe starting to like it. We went to a Chardonnay class and I was like, I hate Chardonnay. Because I'd only had wedding Chardonnay, which is terrible. And Henry had, a range of wines. I actually don't remember what he had. The one I remember was Kim Crawford's unoaked Chardonnay.
Okay.
Which is, nothing outstanding, but it's an example of stainless steel fermented.
It's different.
Chardonnay shows the fruit. And I was like, I had no idea this didn't always taste like popcorn or like butter or like an oak bomb or, a vanilla bomb. And it was only myself, Ian, and Henry at the class. And he had a massive cheese and charcuterie plate and kind of showed us what to pair what with. And then the three of us drank a good part of about 6 bottles of wine. So it was an evening, and he sent us home with them. So it was a fun evening. So we kept taking classes with him and tasting wines. And that was when I learned that rosé was not white Zinfandel, that rosé was an actual thing. We tasted an Amarone because Henry drinks wine during the classes and then opened a bottle for us. Jimmy was pissed. He came over. He was like, why are you opening a $90 bottle of wine? but anyway, that definitely piqued our interest, but we were just consumers. So we started, again, this was over 10 years ago. So we had a notebook, which actually I just found, and we would peel the labels off the wine, stick it on the notebook, and then write tasting notes down. Which I went back and looked, and we were drinking some 05 Bordeaux. I'm like, where did we?
Wow.
Grocery store, and why didn't I hang on to that? But we started being serious as far as 20-something-year-old consumers would be serious, and then that continued to grow. We found wine shops here in DC. Still, we're 100% just consumers, but always interested. If we went to a vineyard, we wanted to, take a tour and not just do a tasting, that kind of thing. But it definitely, when it became an option to become a career, that was when I actually started taking wine classes and really learning about it. And I was like, this is actually interesting. It is not totally different from PT in that the thought process is that you have to understand the land and the soil and the weather and the climate and the sun and the wind. And once you understand that, then you kind of go from there and you figure out what's going to work. And it's art and science combined, which is very much the thinking process in PT. Okay. I feel like I've gotten off topic a little bit, but yeah, Henry and Steph Lowe's was kind of the Kickstarter for just wine is something not just to be, it's not just alcohol. It's something to be enjoyed. There's different kinds of wine. Different kinds of wine are good. And then kind of learning about the actual processes behind it. So.
So I, yeah, as soon as I saw that, I was like, oh my God, I'm a huge Dolphins fan. And my parents swear that the first word out of my mouth was dolphin, not mom or dad. And, you know, I was just, you know, crawling basically when the 72 team was, you know, doing what they were doing with their undefeated season. And they say that's the only time I would sit still. They would like plop me in front of the football game. And I would sit there and watch an entire football game because, you know, and I have been a Dolphin fan. I literally have been a Dolphin fan my entire life, apparently. So
should have worn my Jets jersey today.
Yeah, the picture I saw of you had the Jets jersey. I was like, ah, like, you know, it's a good thing we became friends before I saw that Jets thing.
Not like either of our teams has dominated for a little while.
No. It would be nice if it did, but before completely off of wine, before I met Mike, I used to go to the sports bar every Sunday to watch the Dolphins play. And we were there, and there, you know, there'd be a whole bunch of people that were there the same, you know, we were all watching, and it was always the same people. And after the games, we would like go out in the parking lot, which was really stupid. Now, you know, we're drinking beer all afternoon, and then we go out in a parking lot, and we would play football or something, you know, whatever. And I'm like the only girl that's there that actually really knows football. And so we're playing football, and this one guy, like after like 3 weeks of doing this, he asks me out. And I looked at him like complete surprised, you know, I'm like, what, you know, and I'm like, and without even thinking, and probably a little, you know, alcohol was involved. So the thought process wasn't gone. I'm like, we could never date. And he's like, take it aback. Cause like, we're having a good time. You know, he's like, what do you mean? I'm like, you're a Jets fan. There's no way I could date you. And he never came back to the bar after that. I was like, oh, you know, Mike is a Redskins fan. So, you know, complete opposite, doesn't, you know, there's no interference there. But it's a good thing he wasn't a Jets fan.
He was a Giants fan. So they can also, yeah.
Yeah. Is he in a Giants fan?
Yes. Yeah.
Oh, wow. Wow.
Yeah, we are literally like opposing couples. That's funny.
Wow. More power to you. I don't, that's in the same conference. I don't know. That's a two times a year argument, you know, in my,
yeah.
All right, back to wine. So I get the wolf part name, right? Cause your last name is Wolf, but where does the red come from? Is it wine or hair? That's gingers unite. Yeah. That's what I thought. That's what I thought.
We had a while until I went gray. So we're like, all right, we can pull this off.
That is awesome. That is awesome. I was like, all right, is it the fact that it's red wine? But, you know, you do have white wine. So, you know, I was hoping it was the hair color. All right. So let's go back to South Africa. I have never been there. It's on a bucket list. How frequently do you get to go back there?
I've been twice, for Red Wolf.
Okay.
We went in 2016 to kind of scout wineries, meet wineries the first time. And then we went back in 2018 more to like develop in-person relationships with folks we were working with. And we're hoping to go back next year. The thing is that the way that I can do the best work for the wineries is if I'm selling wine and I can't sell wine over there. So as much as I want to be over there all the time, like we're still definitely in that stage where really I need to focus on the markets and try to grow over here. Next summer, our best friends are moving to Australia on Monday. So we're like, okay, next August we're going to do, cause August is dead in DC typically. Actually, I have like 5 tastings booked, which is rare for me. Sometimes August, like no one wants to see you. But August is usually slow, so I think we'll go over there again next year.
That's awesome. So how exactly do you go about, you know, you said you started with like 8 cases, so, you know, you had like one winery or something. Now you've got a whole portfolio of wines. How are you relating with these people and tasting their wines and saying, yes, I want you, and them saying, yes, I want you. You know, like how are you finding the merger when you're so far away from each other?
We've still, everybody that we've worked with, except one producer, we've been to their farm and we've met them. So most of the people in our portfolio we met in 2016, we probably had 10 to 15 meetings and then walked away working with five people. Battle and Storin, we actually met them at a trade show in New York. It was the the USAT, the one that I met.
Oh, the one that you spoke at?
Yeah. But they were at the tasting part of that. And Gene Azurmendi, who is Babylon Storin's U.S. rep, is just, he's good. And he kind of like saw that we were interested and he really interacted and grabbed us and he followed up via email. So we met him before we went to the winery, but then we did go to the winery last year. For me, I don't know. I'm still new at this. I can't just go into a trade show where everyone's pushing and shoving, taste, 60 wines and pick something I want in my portfolio. I might then have an idea like, okay, I now have a sense for Spanish wine or Portuguese wine or it's more that for me than actually necessarily picking a producer. Mm-hmm. So we felt the need to go down there and we had been saving up airline points for a vacation that we never took for years. So we had a lot of airline points. We were able to go down there. Once you're there, it's pretty affordable. So we don't actually spend that much money when we are down there. But I don't know. I like to have a sense of the place that the wine comes from, a sense of the people, know that you're working with people who you can work with. Because there are some amazing wines made by amazing winemakers who maybe the owners or the export people are just like loopy or or don't answer emails or whatever it is.
Or don't have email.
Don't have email, yeah. So we are small enough that we've been able to do that so far. You know, folks who are huge like Kermit Lynch or, all of these other massive importers, I'm sure they can't do that, but most likely I'm not going to have as big of a portfolio as Kermit Lynch. So I hope that we always can have a personal relationship with the people that we work with.
Right. And now currently, I know you started with South Africa. Are you still only South Africa? I know you're looking to expand.
So yeah, still looking. I think we've decided on what country we're going to work with next. We have a few producers we're interested in. One of our wholesalers has folks that they're interested in. So that's obviously a strong lead. That will be a next step that will probably happen sometime in 2020.
Oh, okay. So not too far.
Not too far, yeah.
Not too far.
You can't, it's not like if you have a ship coming from South Africa, you can then have, some Portuguese wines just packed in there. Like, they're
too separate.
They have to be completely separate, so you have to be able to support both, I guess.
Right. Okay, so I think when the wine you sent me was actually a white blend, which was a Sauvignon Blanc and Semillon. And I'm probably going to pronounce the name wrong.
Villera.
So I, in my brain, I guess I had Chenin Blanc or Pinotage coming to me, right? And I think that, in my mind, I think that's the general populace's thought of South African wine. Do you think that they have this, curtain that people think of South Africa and not going further than those two wines? Is it something that they need to work on to break out of? Are they working on it to break out of it?
Yeah, absolutely. Locally, when you're in South Africa, I mean, I don't even tend to really drink that much Pinotage when I'm there, partially because it's usually, I've gone in there summer, so it's hot. So you're not like, ooh, I want a big
Pinotage.
Yeah. But different regions are different. So Hemelin Arde, which is Cape South Coast, almost the southernmost tip of Africa. If you drive along the coast from Cape Town for about 2 hours, you get there. It is much cooler. They get more rain. And they actually get mist and fog. The mountains there get a little bit of snow in the winter. And the diurnal shifts, the daytime, nighttime temps are very, very different. During the day there in the summer, you might be in shorts and t-shirt, but in the evening, I mean, it's kind of almost like San Francisco. You are wearing jeans and a long sleeve shirt and a jacket. So at their climate, I've never been to Burgundy, but apparently is actually fairly similar to Burgundy. I think it's a little less fickle than Burgundy can be. I know, maybe a little bit less difficult than Burgundy can be, but so there you see mostly Pinot Noir and Chardonnay, but some producers also grow, if they get enough sunlight and are maybe just like a little bit further inland, a little bit warmer, they'll grow Syrah and Pinotage there too, and then also Sauvignon Blanc. Elgin, which is also cool climate because it's very high elevation, a lot of Sauvignon Blanc, they're growing Riesling there. So, but these are all things that weren't, you were not allowed to do this pre-1994.
Oh.
Pre-1994, they were told to plant what, where. Emphasis was on volume, not quality. And again, this wasn't South Africa's biggest problem, but one of the things that was happening was that the wine industry was largely like controlled by co-ops and these groups that would pay farmers based on quantity and volume. So folks were doing quality work. They weren't making any money doing it. And they had they were restricted in what they could plant where. Since 1994, you can plant what you want where. So winemakers and viticulturists are working together and figuring out, oh, in Elgin, we can grow these things. And in Hemelinarde, we can grow these things. Elim is a relatively new region that is further. It's at the southernmost tip of Africa. It's crazy down there, but they make really, really beautiful, cool, cooler climate wines. It's, you know, even though South Africa is a warm climate, there's a lot of diversity in their weather just in the winelands. Stellenbosch, which is warmer, they're starting to focus and really put emphasis on their Cabernet Sauvignon. You're seeing some more Bordeaux varietals come out of there. So like the Sauvignon Blanc Semillon blend that you had. So you see that all over there, and then it's kind of having to, you know, show folks in the States what's going on, and I think that's been a struggle. Wines of South Africa, WOSA, does go around and do master classes. They do tastings, but the issue is, so there's, WOSA has a branch in the UK, they have a branch in China, you know, Germany, they have their own branch, and then there's America. So this one guy, Jim Clark, does America, which is basically, you know, a lot. So I think that's been difficult. And the South African government doesn't do anything to support that. Whereas like the Chilean government has, you know, put money in, the Australians have put money in. So I think there's a struggle in that. So it's importers, sommeliers, people who've been there who live in the States then trying to do that work.
Right. I think that whenever you hear South Africa, people just go, oh, Pinotage, you know, and I guess in America, it's tough for one guy to set it up to introduce people to, hey, there's a lot more than Pinotage. And today's Pinotage is probably very different than it was than it was back then.
Absolutely.
So I was surprised that it wasn't, well, when I saw it was white, I thought it was a Chenin. But then, so it was wonderful. It was a delicious, amazing wine.
Yeah.
So can you tell me a little bit about the winery itself and a little bit more about the wine?
Absolutely. So I have not been drinking wine all morning. I had this bottle out for samples this week because it just arrived to the States. I had samples, that was what I sent you, but it just arrived to the States on like July 3rd.
Oh, okay.
So I picked it up on Tuesday and went out in the market Tuesday through Thursday with it. So Villiera is a winery in Stellenbosch. It's family owned. It's the Greer family. So Kathy, and then her, I think it's her brother and her cousin, the three of them own it. They started making MCC or sparkling wine, Méthode Cap Classique. And we're known as an elite MCC producer, and they have a range of wines at different price points. They also have a range of still wines that they work with as well. this is one of their value wines. So this retails around $15, maybe a little under. So this is their Down to Earth White, which is a symbol of their winery. They are very environmentally focused, very sustainability focused. Mm-hmm. So they don't spray. In the last, I think 17 years ago, they had a spray for some reason or other. But they really try to avoid spraying. So they use natural pest control. They set aside part of their land as like a wildlife refuge, kind of, so they don't plant there. And there's game. I mean, there's no big cats or anything, but they do have zebras and giraffes and various antelope type animals. They recycle their water. They use solar energy. And they also work with the Pebbles Project, which is an organization in South Africa that helps basically mostly with education, but in general for the children of folks who work on the farm. We found them actually, Danny Stettler Sr., former winemaker at Kapsicht, which I'm pronouncing wrong. Sorry, guys, I can't say Kapsicht properly. but we were saying we wanted to try some bubbles, and Danny Stettler recommended that we check out Villiera. So we tasted through their wines, and I was like, wow, these are really good. And I'm looking at the prices, I'm like, these are really good. I emailed their export person, Kathy, one of the owners, and she was at the trade tasting in New York that I met Babylon Stornat, remembered us because she's smart and takes good notes. And she was like, yes, I remember you. Your husband is Ian and you are the physiotherapist. And I was like, she's going to be easy to work with because she is clearly
on the ball,
you know, her game. Yeah. And then I've actually only been to the winery as a tourist. Their tasting room staff I thought was excellent, very well trained. And I've met Kathy since she came over here in March. And we hung out together and visited some customers. So Villiers is great. They've been great to work with. It's, you know, nice knowing that all of the producers we work with they're sustainable. They care about their land. They're all sustainability certified, but their Villiers is really going like a step above, which is kind of cool. Also, if you go there, you can do a wine tasting and then a safari. I'm not sure if you can bring your wine on the safari. You might be separate, but that's kind of cool. Yeah.
That is pretty cool. That is pretty cool. When we did the wine pairing weekend chat, that actually is something I noticed was a common thread between almost all of the wineries that the people in the group chat had gotten, was that Pebbles program, that a lot of them really were giving back. And that's always nice, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. There's obviously still a lot of problems socioeconomically in South Africa. And there's certainly been a history of not treating workers properly. So we definitely want to work with people who treat their employees like employees and pay them properly. And, you know, the folks at Kapsicht too, they pay for the education of all of their farm workers' kids.
Wow.
And if they, like, you have to pay for high school in South Africa, I think they call it like matric or something. As far as those kids will go, they'll pay for it because they don't want those kids to then work on their farm. They want those kids to go do something else.
Wow, that's wonderful.
Yeah.
And costly, but wonderful.
Yeah.
Wonderful.
Yeah, they don't live extravagantly.
Right.
Yeah. But they live well because they always have wine. So
that is good. That is a true point. True point. Yeah. And now, a word from our sponsor. Looking to be in the know about Dracena wines? Want to know when we release our new wines? Find out about all of our accolades and get some behind-the-scenes information? Well, all you need to do is sign up for our newsletter. There is no commitment necessary, and I promise you we won't spam your mailbox with loads of messages. Need another reason to sign up? Quite possibly the best reason? You will immediately get a code for a special discount on all of our wines and be privy to newsletter-only specials. Let Dracena Wines turn your moments into great memories. Sign up simply by heading to our website, dracenawines.com, and fill out the pop-up or sidebar. It will take less than a minute of your time, but the rewards will last forever. All right, so let's get to the confusing part, at least for me. So take us through what an importer is and how you have to deal with the, you know, if you're importing, somebody is exporting, and how does that all work? What, you know, what's the licensing somebody needs? And obviously, you know, I don't need dollar amounts, but I'm sure there were a lot of checks that had to be written to get those licenses. You know, and what do those licenses actually allow you to do?
So there's a national import license. It's called the basic permit. That actually, it's through the TTV, and it's actually free and not like... the paperwork was fairly reasonable. So that basically means that, okay, you are an importer in the United States of America, but you can't then import wine anywhere because every state and territory has different... licensing requirements,
okay.
And sometimes counties in the state have different licensing requirements. So we're based in D.C., so we have a D.C. Import permit, which in D.C. is a little confusing because D.C. doesn't have an import permit. It's a distributor permit that covers both. So in D.C., I'm technically a wholesaler. I can sell to a restaurant directly.
Okay.
But when, and which we did do initially. In most states, you have an import permit that allows you to sell to a wholesaler. If you want to also wholesale, which a lot of people will do, you have to have a separate wholesale license. Okay. In D.C., you do not. So, in most states, you would then sell. So I've got my basic import permit. I've gotten my state permit, which the prices are totally different in different states. The processes are totally different, and the timeline is totally different. Some states, you have to basically assign your wines to a wholesaler. So, like, Virginia and Pennsylvania are commonwealths. So if I'm going to work with a wholesaler in Virginia, I designate, okay, this wholesaler gets this part, this wholesaler gets this part, or the wholesaler gets the whole state. Pennsylvania, they get the whole, it's the whole state. So if you work with somebody who decides, I don't know, maybe they don't have the best business ethics, they can basically, like, hold your wine for, what is the word? They basically have your wine. You now can't find another wholesaler in Pennsylvania until they release it. So you certainly need to work with folks who are going to be somebody you want to work with. And that if you, that relationship doesn't work out, we'll release your wine and let you go somewhere else.
Right.
Let's see. So basic import permit, state license. We're based in D.C., but then we can apply for licenses to sell to different states. And then those wholesalers will either have our wine shipped to their warehouse, or they'll send a trucker and they'll pick it up and then they'll take their wines there. So warehousing, you need a warehouse and you need a space that can hold, you know, 500 plus cases of wine, which inside the District of Columbia is very expensive. So you typically don't want to do that. Plus there's so much traffic and it's far from the port. So we have a warehouse, a commercial warehouse that is near the port of Baltimore, where it's just industrial space. So the cost per square foot is much less. So we have a warehouse there, but then we also need to be able to store samples if I just need to run and grab something quickly. So we also have a very, very small warehouse in DC. So you are paying for each state license, you're paying for your warehousing in your kind of home state areas. Then once I sell the wine to a wholesaler, so it's weird. I'm sure you find this too. It's almost like very handshake business. It's not like, you know, we're like, okay, you will pay me back in 45 days. Like there's just terms. And then if they pay on time or not, so we sell to the wholesaler, then the wholesaler will go and sell to restaurants, shops, that kind of thing, and then reorder from us. So I think that's kind of the basic outline as far as like licensing and order. And then what I find to be the two most challenging things that I'm sure are true in most businesses are cash flow, because I want to pay the wineries on time, but I don't always get paid on time.
Right.
Wholesalers definitely don't always get paid on time. So that can be a challenge. And then supply. Wholesalers, like, or a wholesaler might get a restaurant account that offers your wine by the glass. So that restaurant, for folks who aren't in the industry, if they open that bottle and pour it by the glass and only one customer gets it that day, and the wine, it doesn't, most wines will last 2 to 3 days, but even if they've only served one customer, that bottle's still done. So they still have to now go on to their next bottle. So wine moves very quickly by the glass. So they might go through 3 cases a week. So all of a sudden, the demand for that wine rises, your inventory depletes, and all of a sudden you're out. And my wine is in South Africa, so it's not like I can quickly just get like a quick restock. But on the other hand, if I buy way too much of it, I have to pay to store it, and I have to pay for it from the winery. So timing, timing your stock and making sure that you keep your wholesalers supplied when they need it, because they don't look good if they can't supply a restaurant or a retailer,
right?
But not having so much wine that you can't afford to pay for it because it hasn't sold. So.
Right. And then you said you are, I mean, Washington, D.C. is wonderful. We love, as a winery, we love Washington, D.C. It's just so simple to sell wine to Washington, D.C. So you can go to a retail store yourself in Washington, D.C. and sell your own wine to them.
Yeah, I can. We chose to work with a local wholesaler because we were spending so much time delivering wine and sitting in traffic and delivering wine, and then we got stuck. Like, we weren't growing at all because we were spending all of our time delivering, but we certainly couldn't have paid for a driver and a van at that point. So we decided to work with a wholesaler. I can still legally go and sell a wine directly to a shop, but then I'm kind of stabbing them in the back.
Right.
So we don't do that. If, you know, maybe there's a special account where it's this restaurant who only buys 6 bottles every now and then, and it's not even worth their time. Yeah, they're like, whatever, just do it. But we would always run it by them. But legally, I can go and do it, which is kind of cool because then I legally can go around with samples and try to get new accounts for them, which is unique. So I can't do that for somebody necessarily in Pennsylvania. I would have to go around with them.
Right. Yeah. Okay. So that part is actually very similar to a winery. I mean, I guess basically it's the same thing. You're just using somebody else's wine that you're trying to sell where we're selling it. So in the state of California, I can go anywhere and I can directly sell Dracena wines to anybody. Mm-hmm. In the state of New Jersey, we can also do that, but that's because we pay a huge licensing fee. That wholesale licensing fee for the state of New Jersey, because I spend so much time there that it's worth it for me to go there. But all the other states, we don't, you know, we have to have an individual license to be able to sell it to somebody. But I can't go to, you know, New York and go to a wine shop and sell my wine to New York, because I don't have that license in New York. And that's something I wish, you know, the free the grapes would be a wonderful thing, you know, because it's when you talk to producers out of this country, they're like, every state is its own country when they're trying to deal with the United States. It just, you know, it would be nice if you just had one law, but that I don't think is anywhere in the near future. But it would be nice. Okay, so you kind of answered about how many bottles do you have in your storage facility, and you are using the same wine, or you're dealing with the same wineries vintage after vintage. You're not, so you're signing a contract, handshake contract, whatever. And then, okay, you're out of 2014, so now we need your 2015. It's just kind of like a green contract. You just keep going back.
Kind of. I mean, they have other importers they work with in other countries. So, and a domestic market. So you do want, you want to make sure that, like they have enough wine allocated to you, but you also don't want to like hold their wine captive if you're not going to buy it.
Right.
And kind of, we've only just now gotten big enough that we're doing this, but the producers are like, hey, could you tell us at the beginning of each year how many of each vintage you're going to need? Because we'll just print the labels now, and then when you order wine, boom, the labels are already printed. Because it takes about 2 or 3 weeks to get labels printed.
Right.
It blows everything down. So one thing I'm going to work on at some point if things slow down, is kind of figuring out, this is what we use this year, what do I think I'm going to need next year, so that I can tell the producers in January, hey, I think we're going to want this much of your 2020 Chenin Blanc, so that they can just go ahead and print labels and make their lives easier. So you do, if you work with a massive winery, there may be no issues with allocations. If you work with a smaller winery and they're starting to grow, right, then, you know, if they've got a wholesaler in Belgium who sells more stuff than you, why should they give you wine when they're going to place a large order?
So. Correct. Right. So how you order your wine from your winery in South mm-hmm. Africa, and it's got to go on a ship, a cargo mm-hmm. ship, and then comes here. So how long does it take? What's that process? And so that's something else, I guess, that you have to organize in your brain is yeah. like, all right, it's not coming today. So take us from you're placing the order with the mm-hmm. winery in South Africa. What's the time frame and what happens with that wine?
Okay. So you place your order. If they've already got your labels printed, then okay, that's at least easy for them. They can just put the labels on the bottles. If they don't, because you haven't, you know, given them an idea, at least 2 to 3 weeks for the labeling before yeah. they can even get the goods together.
That labeling that you're talking about is to make it U.S. legal, right?
Yeah.
Because we have different regulations that have to be on the label.
Exactly, yeah. So, like, this label's a little bit beat up because I iced it down. But they've actually got our logo on here, which is kind of cool. Not everybody does that. Imported by Red Wolf Imports, LLC, Washington, D.C. And then it also has to have the U.S. spiel on it about, according to the Surgeon General, right. blah, blah, blah. Because in South Africa, they have different they actually have really awesome back labels, like you should not drink and then walk in the road. That is a label. Like, normally, you'll see one sneak through, like if it doesn't get caught in customs. I've seen them on bottles here. I'm not
awesome.
Going to say which wine because I don't know how their importer doesn't have the right labels. But occasionally, you'll see, do not walk in the road after drinking. You might be killed.
Wow.
That is not acceptable in the States. So, yeah, that worked.
It's true, about, though.
Yeah. We're talking about back label. Front label would only be different if, let's say that, and I'm way too small to do this. I wouldn't do this at this stage. But let's say that we were like, oh, Americans, Villiera, that's just not going to sell. Let's call you something else.
Right.
Some wineries will make a separate label that's different for the U.S. too. So labels get printed, so that might take 2 or 3 weeks if you haven't given them a heads up. And then the winery needs to get the goods together. Well, hold up. Let me back up. You might order something FOB, freight on board, meaning the winery is responsible to pay for the wine to get to the port. Or you might order it Ex Works, meaning you will pay for it to get to the port.
Okay.
So usually the bottle is a little bit cheaper Ex Works because it's a little bit cheaper for the winery. But then you have to coordinate that. So you'll work with a freight forwarder. And depending on your volume of wine you're ordering and the winery you're working on, you know, they'll kind of dictate whether it's FOB or Ex Works. So let's say that it's FOB. Winery is going to get your wine to the port, which is what we've done so far. Your freight forwarder will have an office in South Africa who will communicate with each winery and kind of determine, okay, your goods are going to be – the ship is Friday. If the ship leaves Friday, goods have to be at port Monday or Tuesday that week. So if they're if the wineries are not ready until Wednesday, you're bumped back to the following Friday.
Oh.
So they'll communicate with the wineries and say, okay, so-and-so is good to go, so-and-so's good to go, they need another week, blah, 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 blah. This is the ship we can take. Everybody's got to get their wine to the port by whatever, Monday, whatever the Monday of that week is. Wineries get it to the port and then it becomes my property. Once it's on board, freight on board, it's my property. So the freight forwarder has organized, like, your container is going to be on such and such a ship. You have picked what kind of container you want. We've been doing insulated containers so far, which cost more than just, like, if you were shipping your car, you would just do a standard container. If you were shipping champagne, usually do a refrigerated container, which are very expensive. But we've been able to just do insulated, and so far we haven't had any kind of issue with heat. container gets boarded on the ship. It takes 3 to 4 weeks to get here. Our last ship was 3, and that was nice. I don't know enough about ocean currents to know if it was the time of the year that it was a little faster. But took 3 weeks to get here. Ship docked, I want to say, June 30th, which I believe was a weekend. My warehouse is not open on weekends, which most commercial warehouses are Monday through Friday. So it'll get unloaded, but then I'll just kind of sit in port until the warehouse is ready. So the freight forwarder organizes a trucker, because that trucker has to be licensed to carry alcohol. You can't just put alcohol in, right, in any vehicle commercially. And that trucker will organize getting the wine delivered to your warehouse. So they'll work with your warehouse person. So obviously you're paying the freight forwarder for all of these services.
So is that freight forwarder still the first person that's in South Africa, or now do you have another freight forwarder in the United States?
They're all the same company. Freight forwarders have offices at all.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, there's not that many freight forwarders. Most of them are very big companies. So there's not a lot of, options out there, okay, basically. And one step that I actually skipped, because Ian usually does all this stuff because he's a lawyer and his brain can do that, is customs. You need to clear customs.
Okay.
So either there's some paperwork that has to be done before the freight gets on board. There's some that can be done while it's there. If you have a brand new wine that you're working with, it has to be COLA approved, C-O-L-A.
Right.
And I can't remember what that stands for right now.
That's like the label.
The Label Association, which they get backed up. And when the government was shut down, they got very backed up. Mm-hmm. But they're
yeah, that can take like a week at the most when it's not backed up, because we have to do COLAs, you know.
Oh, you do. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that you can usually do, like, you try to do it before the wine is getting on board, just so you're not, like,
hand labeling.
Wineries have to have certain forms as far as basically making sure that they're FDA approved. Since 9/11, there's been certain paperwork that they have to fill out just to make sure that they're kind of approved to bring in edible goods into the United States. With South Africa, there's certain trade agreements, so paperwork has to be done with that, positive trade agreements that help cut down on taxes. And then you can often, your paperwork can clear customs before the wine even gets here. Mm-hmm. But customs can just go through and inspect your wine. And customs doesn't give a crap if they break a bottle or six. I'm not saying folks are doing it intentionally, but they probably have very packed days, and it's probably very, hard work to do.
Right.
So it's known that goods can get lost if a customs does an inspection. So you don't really want customs to do an inspection. You want to have all your ducks in a row beforehand. And this is one of the positive things about my father-in-law, Kenny, being an import-export attorney. One of his clients, Frankie, he's retired now, but is a customs broker. Frankie was at our wedding. So Frankie was like, yeah, I've been doing this forever. I'm going to make sure everything goes good. You know, also because we were working with an established person, customs didn't give us a hard time coming in. So that makes a difference too. Frankie's sister-in-law works at Albatrans, which is our freight forwarder. So while I'm sure I drive her nuts at times, you know, she's kind of making sure things go well for us. So it helps to just have those personal connections with people,
right,
too.
Right.
So anyway, it's called drayage when your wine moving from the ship to its truck to your warehouse. Then your warehouse will have to input it because they run inventory. So because I'm small, I'm not ordering necessarily. So wine is stacked on pallets. I know you know that, but just for folks, usually it's like 56 to 64 cases in a pallet. A case being a 12-bottle case. In South Africa, they use 6-packs, and the math is confusing. But bigger companies will order one pallet of so-and-so's Cabernet Sauvignon or more, one pallet of so-and-so's Chardonnay, one pallet of this, 3 pallets of that. So it's easy for the warehouse. They just put it over there. We're small, so I might order half a pallet of this and then half a pallet of their sparkling wine. So the pallets are mixed. So the warehouse is like, great. Mm. And then they have to sort through that and stack it because they have to be stacked by the product.
Right.
So that'll take a day or two for them to get that into their system. And they would prefer that you don't take wine while they're trying to do that, or that you don't take those wines while they're trying right. to do that, because it's very easy for them to lose track. So even though my wine arrived on June 30th, it wasn't at my warehouse until July 3rd. And then July 4th was a holiday. The lady who does the computer document, like putting things in the computer, took the vacation. Day off, which good for her, like she should, but then it didn't get done. So I wanted to get my wine on Monday. I couldn't, which works out well because all the roads around here flooded, so it was good to not drive. I went on Tuesday, and I was like, I need to get a couple samples. She was like, that's fine. But it really wasn't ready yet, and the wine was really just ready basically on I think it was Thursday that I got the notification. Wow. So it's still like, because you want your inventory tracked properly, so you don't want to interfere with these folks trying to do their job.
Right.
Because then if your inventory is off, you could mess something up for a customer, and you can't really blame them if you snagged a case before they were ready.
So. Right.
I think that's more or less it, and that is why wine is not super cheap in the States.
Yeah, wow. It takes a long time. It takes a long time and a lot of effort. A lot of effort. All right, so that's all the questions I have. Is there anything that I didn't ask or I didn't cover that you want to tell us about Red Wolf Imports or about yourself?
Sure. So we talked about all of the logistics of getting wine here. Sales, not necessarily selling. So that is like step one. Step two is now you've made a promise to all these people that you're going to help them in their U.S. market. So you also need to be able to go out there and sell the wine. And I never worked in restaurants. I didn't have connections in the industry. And that was actually why we started to be active on social media, even before we had product. So I was like, I don't know anybody, and I can't afford to just go out to eat and go out to bars every night of the week. We need to get to know customers in a different way. So social media has been really cool, not just with meeting restaurants and that kind of thing, but with meeting people in the wine industry, wine community. Because the wine community is really kind of active and kind of cool, and mostly seems to be good people. I thought it might be a lot of good old boys, like older white men who just like Burgundy and Bordeaux. And actually, especially I think here, and I'm sure you're seeing this, you meet a lot of people who are interested and eager and want to learn and want to interact and want to interact with other geeky people who like the same thing that they do. So that's been a really cool community to be involved in too.
Yeah, we did the same thing. We started social media before we had our first release because, without a tasting room, who's going to know who I am,
Right.
So you have to get out there and you have to be you on social media. So with that being said, how can they find you on social media?
At Red Wolf Imports, Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter. I am not super, I don't like tweet a lot. I don't put a lot of content on Twitter. I mostly retweet. I don't know why. Twitter's just not my jam. You're really good at Twitter, but I don't know.
Thank you.
But we do a lot of stuff on Instagram. And then if we're doing events, we're trying to do like some Bry events this summer. So if anyone is DMV area, we're doing a Bry in St. Michael's, Maryland in 2 weeks.
What's a Bry?
A braai is a South African barbecue.
Oh.
B-R-A-A-I. So braai is the only word that is the same in all of South Africa's 11 official languages. And it's something that actually pretty much most people in the country do. Like, because, again, lots of challenges, certainly, in South Africa. But a braai is common between kind of everybody.
Oh, cool.
So I think it was... was it Desmond Tutu? I did the research on this and now I'm blanking. They started this, a public holiday called, I think they call it Heritage Day officially, but they kind of refer to it as National Braai Day. So it's just, it's a cookout. You cook, there's not a lot of vegetarians in South Africa. They grill meat over a flame outside and they hang out and they eat and they drink with friends. But it kind of means more than that. It means getting together. It means putting aside differences and just enjoying this thing that we do together.
That's awesome.
So I like food. I like being outside. I like eating and drinking. So that was there. And then I liked that kind of community. Like, let's go above the things that are our problems and kind of get together over this one thing. So we're hosting Rye events, and we're trying to do more and more of that kind of thing, because that's unique and different. And usually that stuff I'll put out more on Facebook, Instagram, that kind of thing, because it stays longer, and you can go back and relook.
Find it, right? That's awesome.
Yeah.
All right, so I usually end all of these segments with the game of opposites, which I probably should have pre-warned you, but I forgot to. the 4th of July just was a blast. We were away, but then coming back was out of control trying to catch up with everything. But it's super simple. All it is I give you two words, and whichever one resonates with you is what you say. So there's no right or wrong answer. You know, it's I got it from friends. Phoebe did it when Joey wanted to go cross country and didn't know to go north or south route. There's no right answer or wrong answer. I start off with some non-wine terms, and then we get into wine terms. So, all right. So no thinking, whatever, just whatever resonates more. All right. So night or day?
Day.
Okay. Sunset or sunrise?
Sunset.
Black or white?
Black.
Walk or run?
Walk.
Food or drink?
Ooh, drink.
Old world or new world?
Old world.
Sweet or dry?
Dry.
Bubbles or still?
There's no both answer. I'll say bubbles.
Yeah. Oak or stainless?
Stainless.
Drink now or drink later?
Not very good at drinking later, so I drink now.
Intention to drink later, but it gets changed to drink now. Blend or varietal?
Varietal.
Vintage or non-vintage?
Vintage.
Cork or screw cap?
Cork.
Napa or Sonoma?
Sonoma.
Commercial or indigenous?
Indigenous.
Bordeaux or Rhone? Or South Rhone. Africa?
Yeah, Rhone.
Warm climate or cool climate?
Cool.
There you go. See? That's it.
All right.
Yeah. It's funny because it kind of is really a psychological thing also. You know, people tend to go into things. Although you were different than most, because most people who say night say sunset. And people who say day say sunrise.
I realized, I was like, that kind of doesn't make sense.
But that's it. And then, you know, the old world usually says drink later. New world says drink now. But it's kind of, I just like doing it. It's something different. So
we just moved and bought a new house. Part of the reason we moved, we were in a condo and we couldn't store wine. I mean, there was just no space. So we're like, now we have a basement. So now I can actually buy in volume and drink later.
There you go.
It just was never an option before.
Yeah. So. Yeah. You know, if you live in an apartment, there is no option. You have to drink now. So
you do. Yeah. So now our basement is starting to fill up with wine.
There you go. Congratulations on that. Congratulations.
Yeah.
Anyway, well, thank you very much for joining me today and for sharing all that information about importing. It is a web of things that you have to do to bring the amazing wines to us. And if that one bottle that you sent me is any representation of the rest of your portfolio, which I'm sure it is stellar. So best of luck. Congratulations, because I was upset that I drank it in New Jersey because I wanted Mike to taste it. It was so good, you know.
I know, that's awesome.
The good thing was that since Mike wasn't with me, I got the whole bottle. you know, positives and negatives. You know.
Negative. Yeah.
But yeah. it really was stellar, and it was eye-opening to taste such quality wine that, you know, I don't really have a lot of South African wine, so it was stellar. So thank you.
Of course.
All right, and good luck with your new home and all of that stuff and filling your cellar, because that's always fun.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right. Well, thank you very much. And I will talk to you soon, and I will see you on the socials probably pretty quickly.
Yep, absolutely.
All right. Have a great day.
Have a good one, Lori.
Bye. Bye. This has been another episode of Exploring the Wine Glass. Thanks for listening. If you have suggestions on what topics you would like me to discuss, please reach out on social media. You can find me on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook as Exploring the Wine Glass. I'm also on LinkedIn as Lori Hoyt Budd. Of course, you can always email me at exploringthewineglass@gmail.com. If you enjoyed our podcast, please rate, review, and subscribe on your favorite podcast catcher to help others find me more easily. Until next week, Sláinte.